Hey there, sex fans! Welcome back. Today is Monday, September 24th, 2007, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge, with your host, Dr. Dick. That's me. Special announcement. Guess what? DrDickSexAdvice.com has hit a huge milestone. As of this morning, we have exceeded 100,000 unique visitors to the site since it premiered last February. Damn, y'all make me so proud. Today's special program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. Look for the Video On Demand tab right there on the front page of DrDickSexAdvice.com. I know a lot of you have questions about sexual performance issues. Hey doc, what's the best sexual position for butt fucking? How do you give a really great blowjob? Hey, I want to start spanking, but I don't know where to begin. You know, stuff like that. Well, now you don't have to wait for me to respond to your pressing query. Just mosey on over to Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library and let some of the experts show you how it's done. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, wonderfully enriching, and extremely informative videos right there on your computer screen. How sweet is that? I have a really delicious show for you today, but before we begin, I'd like to remind you of the Lickety Split Sex Advice Podcast voicemail hotline at 866-422-5680. This is a free, no pressure, voicemail kind of setup. No human will answer your call, least of all me. So don't be shy, my pretties. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Okay, on with the show. Our first correspondent today is Valerie. She's 38, writes from Dubuque, Iowa. Dr. Dick, I just went through a very painful divorce. My husband of 18 years up and decided that he wanted to start over in a new job, in a new state, with a new girlfriend, someone 12 years his junior. I must be completely blind because I didn't see any of this coming. Sure, we had our problems, what marriage doesn't? I want to move on too, but I feel so stuck. I feel like this really big loser. The few tentative forays I have made into dating have been horrible. Every guy I meet is a lying sack of shit. Sorry, does that sound too bitter? Help! Damn, girl, that's fucked. Big time. It's hell when a relationship goes belly up, and I don't care if they're relationships of business or relationships of the heart. If there's an established bond of trust that is broken, it's gonna smart. And when the bond is broken unilaterally, it's even worse. But what can you expect when you're dealing with humans? Surviving a breakup is not unlike surviving a death. In fact, the demise of a relationship is very much a death in every sense of the word. I believe that every relationship worth talking about has a life of its own. It's greater than the sum of its parts. I gotta tell you, I see a lot of this in my private practice. A couple drags in their relationship, and it's eminently apparent that it's on life support. They've actively throttled the relationship to within an inch of its life, and then they expect me to fix it. Most of the time, the option to fix has long since passed. All we can hope to do at this point is preside over the death of the thing, providing its passing with as much dignity as possible. But to tell the truth, when a relationship is in such grave condition and there is very little goodwill left between the partners, sadly, there's not going to be a lot of dignity when the thing finally expires. It just breaks my heart, but what are you going to do? Many years ago, a therapist working with sick and dying people wrote a book called On Death and Dying. In it, the author Elizabeth Kubler-Ross identified five stages of dying. 1. Denial. 2, anger. 3, bargaining. 4, depression. And 5, acceptance. I find it helpful to use these same identifiable stages to talk about the end of a relationship, particularly a relationship that ends unilaterally. If you don't mind, I'd like to walk through these stages with you so that you can see how applicable they are to someone in your situation. Grieving the death of a loved one or a relationship involves the whole of us, our physical, emotional, and social selves. We have to relearn or cognitively adjust to our new self without the loved one or the relationship. Moving through the end of things is hard work, and to survive that, we need to be patient with ourselves. You, on the other hand, seem to be having a particular problem with this, since you say that you feel like you're a loser. That kind of mindset is not going to be particularly helpful. So, if you could please jettison that kind of thinking, or at least try to have a little bit more compassion for yourself, maybe you could even shelf that self-deprecation for a while, at least until you get your bearings once again. A person is faced with a fact that is too painful to accept, and so she rejects it instead, insisting that it can't possibly be true despite the overwhelming evidence. This is stage one, denial. Honey, I'm moving out. I'm getting a new job in a new state, and oh, I have this new, much younger girlfriend. This can't be happening. Sure, we've had our troubles, I'll grant you that. But so does every relationship. Denying the reality of an unpleasant fact may actually serve a purpose. It's a coping mechanism for dealing with something overwhelming and too shocking to take in at once. We have a gut-wrenching emotional response to the injustice, humiliation, and betrayal. This is stage two, anger. Depending on the kind of person we are, we may actively express our anger by lashing out verbally or physically. Or we may passively express our anger, turning it inward, becoming silent, sulking, or passive-aggressive. We may even consider harming ourselves as a way of punishing the other. We try to fix what's wrong. This is stage three, bargaining. We can make it work. I'll change. I'll promise. I know I can make you happy. Stay for the sake of the kids. What will the neighbors say? This will kill your mother. What does she have that I don't? You'll never be able to show your face in this town again. Any of this sound familiar, Valerie? All our efforts to reverse the inevitable course of things leaves us emotionally drained and exhausted. This is stage four, depression. Why bother with anything? Family, friends, work, personal appearances, whatever. Life as we knew it is over. We can't seem to project ourselves beyond the ending of things. In the bleakness, we often turn to self-medication. A little too much food, booze, drugs. As if depression were not punishing enough, we often pile it on. I've heard some people say, hurting myself is the only thing that makes me feel like I'm still alive. Slowly, we begin to regroup. Maybe it's through sheer willpower or the interventions of family or friends, or maybe it's just time itself. But we stop resisting and move toward acquiescence. This is stage five, acceptance. We stop resisting what we cannot change, even if the end was not chosen, desired, or inescapable. We can still willingly choose to accept it. I hasten to add that these stages are guidelines. They are not presented in an order which they always happen, nor is one stage predicated upon the other? How long a person stays in one stage or another is situational. However, I do hope this was helpful. What is certain is that you will experience a wide range of feelings and emotions during this transitional period. Some suggest the therapy of keeping yourself busy as a means of healing and moving on. This may sound elemental, but it's not always as easy as it seems. Most of us tend to wallow in our misery. We are way too indulgent with sitting on the pity pot. While you definitely need time to recover from the divorce, this period of heartache will have an end. And ends of things always lead to beginnings of other things. You now have certain freedoms that you may not have had while you were married. Once the initial period of grieving is over, it's important for you to jump back into life. Become more involved in your social group. Going out might seem unappealing at first, but it's better than staying home and feeling sorry for yourself. If you're only dating assholes, I'll bet you're fishing in the wrong holes, so to speak. The internet makes it so much easier for us to connect with quality people of every stripe, but I encourage you to use this tool wisely. May I suggest that you start by connecting with people with similar interests as you, rather than posting a profile and photos on a dating site? Of course, it is necessary to have some time with yourself to realize that you can survive and even be happy without your dick of a husband. The secret to successful grieving is that you need to feel the pain in order to work through it. Therefore, using drugs, prescription or recreational, and or alcohol, to numb yourself only will make things worse. You might consider working with a therapist to help you understand why your relationship ended. With a little luck, you'll learn how to avoid blaming yourself for the demise. No one is without fault, and your husband definitely has more than his share, but blaming him for everything that went wrong will do you no good. You are neither totally to blame, nor are you a helpless victim. Lingering at either extreme will rob you of your self-esteem. At first, being single might seem weird or even unappealing, but being single has its perks. Being single allows you to focus on you and take better care of yourself. And what better way to do that than reconnecting with your sexual self? Masturbation is going to be your best friend during this transition period. I invite you to lavish time and pleasure on yourself. You're worth it. Indulge yourself. But instead of chocolate, get yourself a souped-up vibrator and kick that thing into first gear. Maybe even second. By spending more private sexual time with yourself, you'll be able to reconnect with who you are and what you want. This will make it easier for you to later choose a partner who can and will satisfy your needs. While I'm at it, let me invite you to send me information about technique, style, fantasy, settings, and perhaps implements used in your masturbation. I also invite you and all my listeners to submit stories of your earliest masturbation experiences, failures, as well as successes. You can submit your comments on the Jilling Off page. You'll find a link to that resource at the top of drdicksexadvice.com. Good luck! Hey, Dr. Dick, what is that toll-free podcast voicemail telephone number? Why, it's 866-422-5680. Again, 866-422-5680. Next, we hear from Darren, 24, Long Beach. I'm a 24-year-old straight male. On my second tour of duty in Iraq, I took some shrapnel in my back on account of an IED. I've been in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down, ever since. I come from a very strict religious family, so I never was sexually active before the Marines. Now I'm back at home, and while my parents are great caregivers, I can't talk to them about this. I'm afraid that I won't ever get to have sex, but I want to. What should I do? Tough break, pup. As if the war in Iraq weren't bad enough, there is all this collateral damage to our brave and valiant service people. Damn, if we, your countrymen, don't owe you every possible assistance and convenience, I don't know what. I'll admit, your family's religious scruples, coupled with your spinal cord injury, make for a pretty daunting double whammy. So let's start with some of the basics. A lot of people automatically think that a person in a wheelchair can't or is uninterested in having sex. Your parents probably think like this. They surely believe that sex is only for married people, and since you aren't married and you are in a chair, there is no good reason for them to discuss the matter any further. I encourage you not to sink to the lowest common denominator on this. I suspect that since you still have a healthy sex interest, and you want to get laid at some point, hopefully real soon, all we have to do is figure out a clever workaround to your current living situation. To that end, I have some questions for you. Are you afforded any private time and space in your parents' home? Are you getting some physical therapy at a veterans hospital or elsewhere? Are you in a spinal injury support group? Do you have any social outlets other than the medical related ones? Do you still have some jarhead buddies who could swing by and pick you up and take you out? The reason I ask all these questions is that, despite your disability, you're going to have to forge your own independent life away from and out of the control of your parents, good people though they are. Many caregivers, despite their best intentions, have a tendency to smother the people they are caring for. Don't let this happen to you. The only way you will find the fuck you are looking for is if you assert your independence. This move toward independence may have to happen incrementally, but you gotta get started. Clearly, you have access to the internets, or you wouldn't be able to contact me. That's a good start. The internets, they're gonna be your best friend for the duration, count on it. Connect with other similarly challenged vets and civilians online. These folks will be a wealth of information for you about how to take the next steps, pardon the pun, toward independent living. If you're not plugged into an ongoing spinal injury support group, make that happen as soon as possible. Like I said, these folks have information and resources that the professionals who attend you do not have or will not share. If there are any wheelchair fetishists out there, your support group will know about them. And I think you can be pretty certain that there are. You are following me on this, Darren, right? Good. Now, this is where your jarhead buddies will come in handy. Prevail upon them to be your transportation. Parents are good for getting you to and from the hospital and the like, but you don't want to count on them to get you to a tryst or a date, don't you know? One thing for certain, when connecting with chicks online or elsewhere, you need to be pretty upfront about what you want and need. Remember, you have to compensate for people's preconceived ideas about sex and disability. I'll grant you, this is a fine line to tread, again, no pun intended, because you have to be upfront about your desires, but you gotta do it without being a dickhead. You are also at a disadvantage for not having had the opportunity of honing your dating and seduction skills before Iraq. So you're going to have to do some remedial work now. In social situations, and you ought to be getting out to places other than hospitals and support groups, project yourself as a sexual being. Put on a sexual vibe. Not all geeky and weird, but as a matter of confidence. You're a Marine vet, for Christ's sakes. That should be swagger and bragging rights enough. And don't forget, you know something others may not know. You know that you're going to be a freaking terror in the sheets because you're making up for a whole lot of lost time. Make eye contact and smile and be your charming, devilish self. Whatever you do, don't gawk at her tits. They may be pretty as all get out and the object of your eternal desire, but please keep a lid on it. If you're unsure about your skills as a lover, or you just need a little tutorial on how to please a woman, my suggestion is that you connect with a pro. That's right, it's a time-honored way for guys in the service to lose their cherry. And you're still sorta in the service, right? Nowadays, connecting with just the right provider has never been easier thanks to the internet. See, I told you the internet tubes are going to be your best friend for the duration. Seriously, I suspect that you have lots to learn about the ins and outs of sex, no pun intended, so why not see a specialist? One thing for sure, if you're having a difficult time carving out private time and space in your parents' home, or they are the snooping kind, keep your internet searches on a friend's computer. You don't want your parents finding out that you are indeed a sexual being looking to get your freak on. At least, you don't want them to find this out until after you've established your independence, because if they pull the plug on your internet connection before you're on your own, because they think you're a big fat pervert sexual sinner, you're going to be shit out of luck, if you catch my drift. Good luck. Hey, Dr. Dick, what is that toll-free podcast voicemail telephone number again? Why, it's 866-422-5680. Don't be shy. Let it fly. Next, we hear from Michael. He spells it really interestingly, M-I-K-H-A-L-L. He's 18, and he's located at the U of M, although we don't know if it's the University of Massachusetts, Minnesota, Michigan, you know. Anyhow, he says, I've been having wet dreams since I was 13. I thought I would get over this by now, but it's still happening. I'm in college now, and I don't want my roommate to think I'm some kind of freak. Is there any way to make this stop? I remember when I was a kid, I couldn't have been more than 8 or 9, I overheard my older brother telling his friend that he had had a wet dream. I couldn't wrap my head around what he was saying. He was boasting, of course, and it had something to do with sex, that I knew for sure, but why was he so proud of wetting his bed? I was way too self-conscious to ask him about it, so I let my mind just spin out all these fantastic scenarios, and boy, were they ever fantastic. My brother was really cool, so I hoped I would have a wet dream one day too, but I was also dreading it at the same time. Information about sex when it comes in dribs and drabs like this can be really confusing. I finally had my first wet dream a few years later, and I was surprised as hell to wake up with sticky wet sheets and PJs. Interestingly enough, I didn't make the connection between what I had just experienced and what my brother had been talking about a couple years earlier. So, okay, I wasn't all that swift then when I was a kid, but just look at me now. As I look back, I can't honestly tell you how I figured the whole thing out. Probably I pieced together, you know, pieces of information that I was getting from all kinds of places. I did, however, discover that Wet Dreams had a more ominous technical name, a nocturnal emission. That was scary in and of itself. So, okay, here's what we know about wet dreams, and you can bank on this information. When a guy begins puberty, somewhere between the ages of 9 and 13, he starts to produce sperm, and he's able to ejaculate, even though he may not have discovered this on his own. You know, like through jerking off. It is at this point that most guys experience their first wet dreams. While asleep, our little boy cock rubs against the mattress or the sheets, or we may unconsciously fondle ourselves until we squirt. Since this often happens while dreaming, or because of a dream with sexual overtones, a nocturnal emission is also called a sex dream, or the ever-popular dirty dream. Here's something you might not know. Technically, there is a difference between a nocturnal orgasm, which anyone can have at any age, even as an infant, and a nocturnal emission, which only males have, and only after he reaches puberty. I know you're a bit exasperated, Michael, with the continuation of these pesky wet dreams, but it's all quite normal, and I might add, healthy. You clearly have a very active spooge production system going on there, and your body is producing an overabundance of spunk, way more than you need. And it has to get rid of this excess somehow. Believe me, you really wouldn't want it to stay in your system. It wouldn't be healthy. Embarrassment aside, you can be grateful that your bod is working properly and in harmony with nature. Do you recall your first wet dream? Most guys tell me that they thought they had injured themselves somehow, or that somehow they got some sex disease. Too bad our parents don't prepare us for this eventful night. Many kids are so filled with fear and embarrassment that they try to destroy the evidence, getting rid of the sheets, underwear, or pajamas. Another confusing aspect of the kid's first wet dream is the pleasure and arousal he feels. Those of us brought up in religious homes are often filled with shame by this disturbing occurrence. Those of you who are familiar with Dr. Dick's background know that I was a Catholic priest for many years. I know, scary, huh? I don't want to go off topic here and discuss my life as a priest now. We can say that for another time. What I do want to point out is that when I was in the saddle, so to speak, I often had the occasion to hear the confessions of young people. It was remarkable how often young men would confess to a wet dream, like if they had committed some heinous crime. What gives with a culture that instills such shame about things that are so natural and out of our control? Think of it this way. When your bladder gets full, you take a whiz. When your prostate and seminal vesicles get full, you take a jizz. It's just as simple and natural as that. Now, if I were to guess, Michael, I'd speculate that for whatever reason, you're not masturbating all that much, right? The reason I think that is, if you were relieving yourself of your joy juice, you know, like beating off, you'd have much less buildup and fewer wet dreams, if any. Do you see where I'm heading with this? The same thing would be true if you didn't relieve yourself when your bladder got full. You'd piss anyhow, only you'd happen when you weren't able to properly direct it. Get it? Got it? Good. If you want to cut down on those embarrassing wet dreams, milk yourself before you sleep. This way you can direct your spooge into its proper receptacle, like a Kleenex or a dirty sock, just like your peers. I also want to remind you of the current research being done about masturbation. Australian researchers questioned over 1,000 men who had developed prostate cancer and 1,250 men who had not. about their sexual habits. They found those who had ejaculated the most between the ages of 20 and 50 were less likely to develop prostate cancer. The protective effect was greatest while the men were in their 20s. Get this, men who ejaculated more than 5 times a week were a third less likely to develop prostate cancer later in life. Good luck! Well, that's it for today, sex fans. I'm so glad you could join me. Tune in next week for more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you will be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. Look for the Video on Demand tab right there on the front page of DrDickSexAdvice.com. There's no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute kind of deal. Remember that your pay-per-view minutes allow you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Say, would you like to become a sponsor for one or more of my weekly sex advice podcasts? As you know, I plug a product or service at the beginning and end of each show, just like I did there. Each podcast has its own posting on my site, along with the name of the podcast sponsor and a banner for the product or service. The beauty part of this unique opportunity is that once a sponsor's ad is embedded in a particular podcast, that stays there forever. Your sponsorship also underscores your social conscience. Your marketing dollars will not only go to promote your product, but you will be doing so while helping to disseminate badly needed sex education and sexual enrichment messages. Simply put, you just can't get a better bang for your advertising buck. For further information, contact me at Dr. Dick at DrDickSexAdvice.com. That's Dr. Dick at DrDickSexAdvice.com. And look for Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section under Health, subcategory Sexuality. Or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. And don't forget to subscribe. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex is even better. Over and out.